Okay. So last week we finished Perek Chaf, which was Avram davening for Avimelech, and Avimelech got better due to Avram's tefilos. Avimelech his entire family, and now we're moving on to Perek Chaf Aleph, page 94. So Pasuk Aleph, right there in the middle of the page, Hashem pokad es Sarah. Kasher Amar, and Hashem visited or remembered Sarah, like he had said. But yes, Hashem l'sar kasher diber. And he did to her as he had spoken. So if you look at Rashi here, towards the bottom of the first column, Aleph, Hashem pokad es Sarah, samach parsha zulo kan. This parsha, meaning this story of Sarah finally being able to have a child, is next to the story of Avram davening for Avimelech. To teach you, whoever invokes mercy, davens for his friend, and he himself is something as well, then the person who's davening will actually be answered first for that thing that he's davening for, even though he's not davening for himself, he's davening for somebody else. Shenemar, as it says, he's pala and he davened. And then it, right next to it says, Hashem pakad es Sarah. Then Hashem remembered Sarah, Shapakta kavar kodem shirifei samelach, that he had already remembered her before Avimelech even got cured. Meaning Sarah already conceived, or the process was set into motion before Avimelech was cured from Avram's tefilas. So the Etio, this is actually Gemara Bava Kama that Rashi's quoting, and why does that work? Meaning, why should a person be answered first if they are davening for somebody else? So the Etz Yosef, who's one of the major commentators on the Agadata, he says on that Gemara that the way it works, obviously these are mystical ideas, we're speaking allegorically, but that when you daven for somebody, the Yeshua, the salvation, is coming through you, meaning God is sending it via your tefillos. Whatever is broken in that person that they need help with, be it financial, be it health, be it children, whatever it is, but that conduit from Shemayim, from heaven, which is going to allow them to succeed in that area of petition, it's coming via the person who's davening for them. It's passing through that person. So since it passes through that person, they get the benefit as well, even before it hits its target, which is the person they're davening for. So when you daven for somebody else with sincerity, then you get the full benefit of that tefillah as well, even though it's not you who are davening for it. Rabbi Yashiv Zatzal did point out that this is very difficult, meaning it does sound like a great, like a free pass, almost anything you want. Daven for another person who needs that thing. And he said, halavai, we should daven normal just for ourselves. It's very hard to daven with sincerity, with true emotional sincerity, for another person. Most people don't have that empathetic capability to really daven for somebody else. I mean, you daven, but you don't feel it. You're not davening with the passion you normally would if you yourself had the pain. But in the cases where you can develop that empathy for another person so their pain is truly, truly your pain. Then when you daven for them, that Yeshua, that salvation passes through you and you benefit 100% as well. This notion that we can relate to others the things which we ourselves possess. One of the famous Hasidic rabbis, Meir Mikramislan, in his community, once a maggid came and spoke. And in those days, as we've mentioned before, the entertainment, they didn't have movie theaters, there weren't plays. If you were in the shtetl, there was nothing to do. So how did the common man, so to speak, entertain themselves? It caused problems for the Jews. If you're not Jewish, you get drunk, right? And then you hurt Jews. But what do the Jews do? So what do they do to pass the time? Obviously you learn, if you're not the biggest scholar, what were you supposed to do? So they had traveling magida, meaning it was sometimes tamei chachamim, sometimes a little bit less than people who were so scholarly, who would go around. They would have often prepared drushas, meaning a long 2 to 3 hour sermon, both stories and allegories and jokes and the whole thing, teaching a spiritual lesson based on Chumash usually. And that would be the entertainment, meaning the Maggid would come into town, he would darshan, and at some point he would pass around the hat and people would, you know, throw in a few coins, and that's how he supported himself. So a Maggid came to town and he gave an incredible fiery drasha, and he didn't collect so much money. And then later when he was taking leave from the Rebbe, the mayor, he was sitting there and people were coming in because he was a great Hasidic Rebbe. And one of the things that is more common by the Chassidish Rebbes is that you you give a pidyon, I mean you pay a little bit of money, and that money is usually earmarked for tzedakah, although you just hand it straight to the Rebbe and he takes it. And it's understood, meaning the hashkafa behind it is that it shows you're invested. You're not just stop asking the Rebbe for a favor, but it's something that's important to you. You show that by paying for it. Fine, you give it a chashivas. So person after person after person are coming in and giving the Rebbe extravagant amounts of money and asking him for things. And the Maggid is sitting there and his eyes are like getting big, and he didn't collect so much. And after a while, he can't contain himself. He's like, Rebbe, I gave this incredible drasha. Fired them up. Everybody was so excited, and I barely made anything, and yet here you are doing nothing, so to speak, and they're just handing you money and money. Like, well, what's going on? So the Rebbe said, I'll tell you that it has to do with the idea we just mentioned, that the Pasuk in Mishlei says, Kemayim panim panim, that you face another person. It's like water, that water flows. So if you feel a certain emotion or a certain idea, that gets transmitted to the other person as well, and they feel it back. So in general, we understand the Pasuk Mishlei, meaning if you're happy with another person, they'll be happy with you. And if you dislike another person, even if you do your best to hide it, subconsciously they'll sense it, and they won't be as happy with you either. So Reb Meir said, in this case, it has to do with money. He said, you, Mr. Maggid, you very much like money, which means you want to keep it. So when you talk to people, you make them want to keep their money also. But I like giving it away. So when I talk to people, they want to give it to me. And everybody's happy. Okay. The Pasuk continues in Pasuk Beis, Vatahar, Sarah conceived, Vatelet Sarah, and she gave birth to Avram, for Avram, Ben Zakunab, a son in his old age, Lamoid Asher Diber Oso Elokim, at the time which Hashem spoke regarding, meaning, if you recall, when we spoke about the Malachim, the angels who came and visited Avraham, they said, at this time next year, Sarah will give birth. So indeed, this was the time that had been preordained. If we look in Rashi here, towards the top of the second column, Beis Lizakunav, so Rashi quotes the Medrash here, his old age, but you can also read that as sort of a acronym, that the word Lizakunav could be read Shaya Ziv Ikunin, that it was the image of who he was. Shalo, Domelo, meaning he was comparable to him, meaning Yitzchak bore a very strong facial resemblance to Avraham. It was clearly his child. And so why was that so important? Let's continue in Rashi. L'mod asher diber, Rabbi Yudin, Rabbi Cham, Rabbi Yudin Omer, Milame Chenola L'tesha Chadashim, he was born after a full 9 months. Shalo yamru mibeis hoshavi melechu, in order that people shouldn't say that he came from Avimelech. So Avimelech had happened more recently. And now that's where we're understanding what the significance is. Because for, again, Avram was 100 years old. Sarah was 90 years old. They had been married forever. They never had any children. Then all of a sudden, she gets kidnapped by Avimelech for a night or two. And then, look what happens. Almost a year later, she gives birth to a baby. So everybody was suspicious. So the first thing, there's going to be a lot of indicators that indicate that it was really Avram and not Avimelech in order to assuage people's doubts. The first one was that Yitzchak looked very much like Avram in a way that was, unquestionable. The second thing was that the timing worked out, that it really had to have been Avram. It didn't make sense that she would have given birth if she had been impregnated by Avimelech relatively recently.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What kind of dates are we talking about that this all happened in history?
When?
What are the
How many
dates.
Years ago?
Yeah, how many years ago?
So Avraham, in Jewish years, we're now in 57, I don't remember.
85?
Something like that?
57, 85.
So that year, 5785, Avraham was born in those years, in Jewish years, in 1948. So... So if you subtract, it's almost, 3,500 years or so ago. So, yeah.
37.
Okay. Good. So the pasuk, Rashi continues. L'moed asher dibir, l'moed asher dibir oso. So oso here means regarding it. And Rashi quotes the Targum here, demala yase, that he... And Hashem spoke regarding that specific time, es hamoed asher diber v'kava, the time that he had assigned, set up, k'shamar lein lemoed asher v'lachom, when the angel said, at that time I will return to you, sarat lo srita b'kosel. He had actually made a mark on the wall, amar lo, and he said to him, k'shtigirecham lo srita zu, when the sun reaches this mark again, v'shana acharis, in the next year, teleit, that's when sarat will give birth. So it was, and that sounds like it was for Avraham's sake, meaning the fact that Yitzchak looked like Avraham, that maybe would have been for the public's sake, but Avraham also had his sake. Obviously he believed and everything else, but it's very hard not to have suspicions when nature's arguing against your belief. So the fact that Sarah gave birth exactly on the day that God prophesied was a very strong, reaffirmation in who the paternity of this child was. Continuing in the Pesukim, Vayikra Avram Hashem beno hanola lo, asher yoda lo, Sarah Yitzchak. So Avram called the child that was born to him, which Sarah gave birth to him, Yitzchak. There's obviously a lot of repetition in this pasuk, but Rashi doesn't comment on it. So we're going to also not comment on it. Pasuk Dalet, Vayama Avram es Yitzchak beno ben shmona yamim. He circumcised him at 8 days. Kasher tziva oso elokim, as God had commanded him. So even though Avram and all of his family had also been circumcised previously, Yitzchak was actually the first child who was circumcised at the proper time, which is significant, but out of the context of what we're doing right now. Avram ben Maas Shana Bivale Lo, Pasike. Avram was 100 years old when Yitzchak was born to him, as Yitzchak Bano. Vatomer Sarah, and then Sarah said at the birth of Yitzchak, meaning, and to here we see the name having a connotation, Schok Asali Elkim, God has made for me like laughter or joy. Ko Hashemea Yisachakli, whoever hears will laugh for me. So if you look in Rashi in the middle of the second column, Yitzachek li, Yismach alai, they will be happy for me. Medrash Agada, but the Medrash says, Harbe ikaras nifkdu ima. Why were people happy for her? Is because many other women who had been barren at that time were remembered at the same time, meaning they also were able to give birth when previously they weren't able to. Harbe cholim nisrapa b'b'yom, many sick people were healed on that day. Harbe tefilos nana ima, many tefilos were answered with her. Rav schol kayib olam, there was much joy and laughter in the world when Sarah gave birth. So we can understand this also as well from the fact that we said before that all the tefilos that Abraham invested in the world and they came down via he and his wife Sarah, they bore fruit, not just for Abraham and Sarah, but for everybody else as well. The next pasuk, Zion, Vatomer mi mila la Avram hinika banim Sarah, and she said, who will tell Avraham that Sarah is nursing children? Kiladati bein l'skuna, for I given birth a son in his old age. So Rashi says in Zion, mi mila la Avram loshan sheva v'chashivas, that this is a language of praise, meaning she was saying it as a praise. Who's going to tell Avraham that such an amazing thing has happened? The Ramban points out that the reason why that Rashi is significant, of course she meant it as a positive thing, who wouldn't, is that actually the language of Milel is usually sarcastic. If you look throughout Tanakh, whenever it has that language, it's people expressing disbelief at something usually. That's why Rashi has to say, in this case, obviously, Sarah's not expressing disbelief, but she's doing it in a language of Shevach v'chashiva. She's praising what happened. The Ramban says, though, you can really understand it as a language of disbelief as well, that she's faulting the others, meaning nobody else thought this could possibly happen, and that's why it's such a an amazing thing to, yes, have happened. The Rashi continues in the next Rashi. If we look down four lines from the bottom, Hinika banim Sara, could Sara be nursing children? So Umahu banim Lashon Rabin. Why does it say that Sara is nursing children? It should have said Sara is nursing her son, not children in general, like not many children. So the Medrash understands from that Biyom Hamishta, on the day of the party for Yitzchak, Heviu Hasaras Benem Imahem, the royalty, the royal women, brought their children with them, Venika Osam, and Sarah nursed all of them. She'ein Omro, Shahayu Omros, because these people were saying, meaning her, so, you know, her so-called friends, her peers, Lo Yalda Sarah, that Sarah didn't give birth, she's 90 years old, and they never had a child for like, however many years they were married. This is not their child. Clearly, they desperately want a child. Desperate people do desperate things. What did they do? They found an orphan, some street kid, and they brought him into the house, a baby somebody didn't want, and they said, look, we had a baby, mazel tov. So how do you disprove that? You disprove it if Sarah's able to nurse, meaning she's clearly had a baby on her own, which gave her the power to nurse him, and each of her friends had the same thought and brought her baby and conveniently forgot their nursemaid at home, and Sarah nursed them as well to encourage belief. This is always a problem that we have even people we like, we tend to be dismissive of their good fortune for some reason. We feel a need to knock people when things happen and not to share in the elation that they're experiencing. For whatever reason the Yetzer Hara does it for us, we're okay with, if we see somebody not related to us, like on TV or something, a feel-good story, so then we're uplifted. But when it actually happens to somebody very close to us, for whatever reason, we tend to be dismissive a little bit for all the commotion and excitement. Rav Meir Simcha, who eventually known as one of the Gedolei Ador, he wrote the Meshech Chachma, he was the Rav in Divinsk. And but even as a young man, he was already well known as a huge Eloi genius in Torah and destined to be one of the great ones of the generation. When he was learning in Bialystok, which is where his father-in-law lived, as a young Kolo man with already an excellent reputation, the city of Bialystok had an opportunity to look for a new Rav. And they chose somebody who was not on the level of Rav Meir Simcha. Meaning Rav Meir Simcha was a once in a generation kind of fine. They chose somebody who wasn't close. Even though there had been a few people saying, look, we have Rav Meir Simcha here. So when they asked Rav Meir Simcha about it, he said he's not surprised. He doesn't feel bad about it. But he said, we see it a few parshias ago, Parshas Kisisa, that when the Jews were faced with a leadership challenge. They needed to find a leader. They thought Moshe had died. He had gone up on the mountain. They counted 40 days. He hadn't come down. They needed to find somebody new. So they turned to Aaron and they said, make for us like an idol, golden calf, whatever it is, to function as our leader. So Rav Meir said, I don't understand. They had Aaron. Aaron was clearly a Gadol Hador. He was Moshe's brother. He was head and shoulders above everybody else. And he was obviously the first Kohen Gadol. He was somebody who was unanimously admired by everybody. And so why didn't they go for Aaron? Like, what, that would have been a logical choice. He said, no, you see from there that they're willing to, an eagle zor, he said, right? A strange cow rather than somebody who's related to them. We have to understand our feelings towards family are often irrational. And once we identify the irrationality, it helps us get past it a little bit.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Yeah. Aaron also, I don't know if I heard correctly, but he also was a little bit involved in the scene of the golden calf, right?
He was trying to mitigate it, meaning they were approaching him. There became a, what's called a grassroots movement amongst the Jews to create something that would function as their leader. And the concept of a idol, which, okay, a quick diversion for the golden calf, just so we understand the context. The Rishonim and Chazal understand that when it said the Jews built a golden calf to lead them after Moshe Rabbeinu, they thought had been Nifter at that point and they didn't have leadership, it wasn't because they believed in idol worship. They just went through the Exodus from Egypt. They saw all the miracles and they crossed the, you know, the ocean miraculous manner. God was saving them personally 29 ways from Sunday, and by the Kriyas Yamsuf itself, by the splitting of the Red Sea, it says that a maidservant saw by the Red Sea, meaning she had a visible kind of prophecy, that a tangible kind of prophecy that not even Yechezkel was able to accomplish. Meaning there was a very direct and open revelation of God's sovereignty in the world by Kriyas Yamsuf. So these were not people who disbelieved in God. They didn't have that issue. So then what were they doing? Well, why was there a request for a golden calf? So Chazal say that it was not to worship idols per se. It was when you think about God and you accept Hashem and you want him to be your father, your leader, and everything else that that the Svarim indicate, it's very hard to do because, as we say in Adon Olam, Ein Lo Guf, there's no physical representation of God. So for you to just think about God, you're thinking about nothing. We don't have any, our minds don't do well with ambiguity. It's very hard to focus on nothing and accept that. So we need something. We need something to focus on that can lead us to that thing. We know, and the Torah acknowledges that as well. It says by, we don't have techeilas, most people today, by their tzitzits, the blue string and the tzitzits, but it says that the techeilas and the tzitzits, when you look at the techeilas, it reminds you of the ocean, which is blue, which reminds you of the rikia, of the sky, and from the sky, you think about the kisei hakavod, God's you know, representation, so on. From the kisei hakavod, you think about Hashem himself. So there can be a mental process that brings you to a point where you can not fully understand God, but at least conceive of him via different analogies that mentally bring you there. But just to say, think about God, there's nothing to think about. There's no way to do it. So the people said, we need something. Before we had Moshe, who was able to facilitate our thoughts in such a way that he led us in that mental journey to appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But now what do we do if we don't have Moshe? Let's have a physical representation, and indeed, the Kisei HaKavod, the heavenly throne, has four sides. The Navi Yechezkel says one of them is a shore, one of them is the face of an ox. So it, without getting into the symbolism, it does have serious divine representation, that animal. And they said, let us create that image, and we'll think about it, and via that, we'll be able to ascend and think about God as well. But at least still, we need a starting point. Their mistake was Hashem said not to do it, that Hashem can never have a representation. Even though it makes our job much, much harder, the danger of representing Hashem is infinitely worse for many reasons. And meaning you're almost always going to come to some limitation of Hashem's capacity and ability if you visualize them via a physical representation. So that's why there's an absolute prohibition against any kind of physical representation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But they were saying it for the right reasons. We need something to think about Hashem. So that was their chait. When they came to, when that idea swelled and it took root in the Jewish people, it initially became known, and there was like an upswelling of you know, voices that we need to do something about this. Let's build a calf. And Hur, who was the son of Miriam, he was a tzaddik, a righteous, and he resisted them. Publicly, he said, you can't do this. It leads to destruction. And they killed him, actually. They killed him, they felt, for religious reasons. Here we are trying to connect to Hashem. You're holding us back. You need to go. So when Aaron saw that they were willing to resort in their misguided notions, even to murder, to facilitate that, he realized he couldn't stand against them. So because of that, he said he's going to go with plan B. His thought process was, I'll try to delay them long enough until Moshe comes down, which eventually he did. If I could delay them long enough, then they'll see the error of their ways. And that's what he tried to do. He said, fine, let's do it tomorrow. Right? That was his first statement. And then his next statement was, we can start collecting the gold today. And he figured nobody would want to give up their gold. And he had a lot of these statements that were trying to delay what they planned on doing. But, as fate would have, as Hashem would have it, it didn't work. The women, Taka, refused to give up their gold, but they did for righteous reasons. The men, who had plenty of gold themselves, were more than happy. The Chazal say, B'derach Mashal, they were so excited they were ripping the earrings out of their ears to give it to the Egal Zahav. And then magically, however it worked, the gold was thrown to the fire without Aaron's consent, and out popped the Egal HaZahav. Fine. So that being the case, though, Aaron was against the Egal HaZahav. He, even though he was the one, in their eyes, who was helping them build it. And we're just pointing out here, why didn't they choose Aaron, though, was because they had familiarity with him, and familiarity, to a large degree, breeds contempt. And they did not want Aaron to be their leader. continuing on in Pasuk Ches. The last Pasuk on the page, Vayigdal HaYelem, the child grew, which Vayigdal really means he attained godless. He became a gadol. Vayigamal, and he was weaned. Vayas Avram Mishta Gadol. And Avram made a great party, B'yom Higamalas Yitzchak, on the day that he weaned Yitzchak. So if we look at Rashi, two lines from the bottom, V'yigamel, L'sof Chavdal Chodesh, at the end of 24 months. So Yitzchak was 2 years old when he was weaned, and yet we also have this language of Yigdal, that he achieved maturity. So both are true, and it doesn't happen that way today, obviously, but in the times of Tanakh, and this answers a lot of questions which people always struggle with, is that nature was different, meaning human development was different. People developed much, much earlier. So that at an earlier age, they were already a gadol, so to speak, like a bar mitzvah boy. He was a bar mitzvah boy, or the equivalent of such, at 2 years old. And we'll find this later, just to forestall any questions in this regard, by the ages of the girls when they got married. We'll find by Rivka, she was very young, and other women in Tanakh, that when they got married was at a very young age. It wasn't the same. In fact, the Gemara, at some point it changed, obviously. It was already much different in the times of the Gemara. Hillel and Shammai, the famous Tanaim, have an argument about, are you allowed to extrapolate from the way people behaved at the ages in those days to the way the ages were in their times? Meaning, even though the nature had changed, do we still allow that perhaps people could revert back to that, to us seems like an accelerated nature, to them it was normal. And even for us, it shouldn't be so surprising, meaning humans and those animals closely related to humans take a long time to mature, to hit maturity. Other animals, you can have like a full-grown, a cow, in 3 years. And it doesn't take anywhere near as long as it takes for humans to mature. There's no reason biologically why humans have to mature so slowly. It's just that's the way it is now. But theoretically, people could be fully grown when they're 2 or 3 years old as well, just like many, many other bigger animals in the animal kingdom are. We find this even in the times going further into Tanakh, like Shmuel HaNavi, that when Shmuel was born and he was weaned, also at this age, and he, at 3 years old, and then he entered, at 2 years old, he was given over to Eli HaKohen, who was the Kohen Gadol on the base of Mikdash. His mother had made a promise when she davened to Hashem by the base of Mikdash, that she would give her son to Hashem's avoda, meaning she was if she could only have a son, she was willing to give him up, as it were, for the sake of her Kadosh Baruch Hu. So she, her tefillos were answered. She kept him until he was weaned at two, at which point he was given over to the Beis HaMikdash. He was a Levi to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And Eli HaKohen was, who was the Kohen Gadol, was the one who was in charge of him. But the Gemara records, based on the Pesukim there, that Shmuel was already a fully functioning individual, so much so that he argued with Eli on certain points of halacha when he came into the Beis HaMikdash. He felt things were being done wrong. So obviously we're all familiar with our own kids having that level of brazenness, right? In our families, they'll tell us what we're doing wrong and how it should be happening, but not from a two-year-old per se. But that's what Shmuel was doing, and so clearly the maturity took a different route, which at some point from the time Tanakh was concluded until the times of the Tanayim, which was circa the year, zero, really, of the Common Era, that nature changed and people started taking longer times to mature. And then for the next 2,000 years, things pretty much remained the same, that people, when they were 13, 14, in Europe even, until relatively recently, meaning about 100 years ago, people could get married when they were 13, and that was perfectly acceptable, perfectly normal. Netziv, the Rosh Hashiva of Elashin, Talis Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he was married when he was 13, and it wasn't odd. That was just, people were mature, they got married, they had families, they went to work, they could, if a teenager's trained, he has the physical capacity to work, we just say he doesn't have the emotional maturity yet. But in those days, it was different for whatever reason. It's only relatively recently, and almost an American phenomenon, that we have a concept of teenagers who I don't know, unclear what to do with them until we get them out of the house. Yeah.
So, what you're explaining, you're basing that the nature was different then.
Yes.
And you're basing that on the Gemara.
Everything. I mean, the psukim themselves.
Any kind of historical. Other
When Chazal say how old Rivka was when she got married, or when let's say Rachel and Leah or others, we can determine based on the chronology that's explicit in Chumash how old they were. Meaning, we know that Yitzchak was born when Avram was this age, and whatever. There are many ages given in Chumash from which you can then figure out everybody else's ages. So we know at what age Rivka was born. We also know at what age she was tending her father's, flock and things like that. You can't give a two, no matter how mature, capable a three-year-old is, let's say, they cannot be a shepherd. I mean, that's beyond their capacity. And yet it seemed it wasn't a big deal in those days that a three-year-old should have that kind of responsibility. So it seems implicit from the Tanakh itself that that's what was happening. And of course, the Gemara and Midrashim discuss it extensively as well. And they also say, I mean, that's why I mentioned Hillel and Shammai, that's not our reality anymore. Meaning, and they have a disagreement to what degree can you, reference that reality for halachic purposes, or do you just have to go with what the contemporary reality is in terms of people's maturity. Okay, so moving on to the next pasuk test, turn the page. Vatera Sarah es ben Hagar Mitzvus.
Where are we?
And the next page, the top line, 96. Vatera Sarah es ben Hagar Mitzvus, and Sarah saw that the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, Asher Yalda Avram, that she had born to Avram, meaning Hagar's son Yishmael, Mitzachik, he was playing around. So what does that mean? What does that mean, Mitzachik? So if you look in Rashi, Rashi's going to say, even though Mitzachik means something general, like playing around in some way or doing something frivolous, we can more accurately define it from its various other contexts that we find throughout Tanakh. So in the top line there, Rashi says, Mitzachik, Lashon Avodos Chachavim. First, Rashi says it has a connotation of avodah zarah, of worshiping idols. Kamo she'namar, as it says in the pasuk vayikum le'tzachek, which is in Shemos, which there it's in the. That's what we actually were just talking about was the chet ha'egel, that at some point after they had built the egel, they had formed it, it did turn into full-blown idol worship. So that's that language, the letzachik, is a connotation of idol worship. Dabar acher, Rashi says, lashon gilui arayos. It has also a connotation of illicit relations, meaning forbidden relations. Kamo detem letzachik bi, and we see that usage when the wife of Potiphar accuses Yosef, who was a slave in their household. She was trying to seduce him, but when it didn't work out, she accused him of trying to rape her, and she told her husband accusingly, "You brought in a Jew into our house, letzachik bi, to fool around with me," meaning that he could take his will with me. So you see there that the lashon letzachik has a connotation of illicit relations as well. And davar, and yet another place, another connotation is lashon tzicha, that it has a connotation of murder. So that's talking about where the Jewish people were having a fight, and the soldiers were fighting with each other, and the general used he was faulted for it, but a frivolous language. He's saying, let the boys begin their fun, meaning the soldiers, for them to start fighting. But you see there, they were trying to kill each other. So schok has a connotation of killing as well. So Sarah saw these behaviors in Yishmael. We'll read one more pasuk, and they'll become a little more explicit. Pasuk yod up on top. Vatomer la Avraham, and Sarah said to Avraham, Garash ha'am hazos v'espana, chase out this maidservant and her son. Kilo yirash ben ha'ama hazos imbini im yitzchak. The son of this maidservant will not inherit with my son with Yitzchak. So if you look in Rashi, the third line, imbini yud imbini v'gomer, made chuvash Sarah from the response of Sarah. Kilo yirash ben ha'ama hazos imbini, that the son of this maidservant should not inherit with my son. Lama chaya Mary of Yitzchak al Yerusha. You find that you can infer that Yishmael was arguing with Yitzchak regarding the inheritance from Avraham. The Omer and Yishmael said, "Ani b'chor, what you know? Everybody's so excited about you, Yitzchak. They're making the big parties for you, but I was the firstborn. But no tal pishnayim. I get, because I'm firstborn, a double portion of the inheritance, meaning I'm going to be the last one laughing." V'yotzem l'sada, and they went out to the field. V'notel kashto, and Yishmael had his bow with him. V'yaro bo chitzim, and he was shooting arrows at the young Yitzchak. K'modat Amar, k'mishal hayor zekin. Fine. V'amar, and Yishmael excused himself by saying, "Hello, masachikani. I'm just fooling around. Nobody's getting hurt. Don't worry. It's not a problem." But Sarah was able to read in Yishmael's actions that actually something nefarious was taking place. It might not have come to fruition yet, but she was able to accurately read Yishmael's true intentions. If we continue in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayera Hadavar Ma'od Be'enei Avraham. This was very bad in the eyes of Avraham, this whole incident. Alodos Beno, regarding his son. So Rashi says in Yud Aleph, Alodos Beno, Sheshama Shiyatzel Tarbosra. So Rashi interprets, what does it mean concerning his son? What exactly upset Avraham about this situation was that he heard, not that he observed, but he heard from other people, namely Sarah, that his son was going out, he was turning out badly. Tarbos Ra means like you fall in with a bad crowd, a bad community, something like that. He was going down a road that Avram didn't intend for him to take. So that was very painful for Avraham. Obviously, he loved Yishmael, and he invested in him as a father would. And to see a son so, it wasn't quite explicit yet, but to see that he was taking a turn in a way that was totally opposite, antithetical to Avraham's moral lifestyle, was very, very disconcerting to Avraham. Upshuto, Rashi says, but the simple understanding here is Asha Amasol L'Shacho, that what Avraham was really upset about was that Sarah told him to send him away. So here, the Ma'aral, the Gor Aryeh, he says, I don't understand. Why is Avraham so upset with this pronouncement? Meaning, if Yishmael is bad, then Yishmael is bad. Like, what are you going to do? So he said, no, Avraham viewed the situation very differently from Sarah. That Avraham viewed it as, again, Yishmael was not Sarah's son. It was Avraham and Hagar's son. Avraham viewed him with the somewhat the rose-tinted lenses of a father. And he said, yeah, okay, he's not doing the best right now. But that's what young people do. They have to go through a process of discovery. They do bad things. They misbehave. And at some point, you know, things work out. And of course, Avraham was involved in Yishmael's ethical disciplining. And of course he gave him Musar, and of course he was the stern father when he had to be to put Yishmael on the right path. And he believed that, you know, as happens, if you put in your efforts, then eventually the child matures and they come back. But that's as long as you keep them. If you send them away, if you throw them out of the house, you're closing the door on that that emotional path, on that path of maturity, of being able to come back. So he was okay with Sarah not being happy with Yishmael and scolding him and doing whatever is necessary, but to actually close the door on Yishmael and send him away, which means you're making an irrevocable split in that father-son relationship from a moral perspective, then that Avraham couldn't deal with that. That was something that he was not ready to do, even though Sarah said so. But then, surprisingly, Hashem weighs in on this argument as well. It says in Pasuk, let's go back to top, on Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayomer Elokim Avraham. At this point, Avraham got prophecy. Hashem spoke to Avraham, and he said as follows, Al Yera Beinecha Al Nara Masecha. You don't feel bad about the youth and your maidservant. Kol Asher Tomer Elecha Sarah, everything that Sarah says to you, Shema b'kola, listen to her voice, meaning you have to do what Sarah says. Ki v'Yitzchak yikar l'cha Zara, for it's in Yitzchak alone that he will be considered your progeny. And Yishmael will not be considered your true lineage, only Yitzchak. Well, if we look in Rashi, a little bit below the first half of the first column, Yud Beis, Shema b'kola, that listen to her voice, b'kol ruach hakodesh haba, in the voice of the heavenly spirit that is within her. Lamadnu, this teaches us, shaya Avram tafel Sarah, that Avram was in some way subservient to Sarah, benevius, in terms of the level of prophecy, that Sarah's prophetic ability exceeded that of Avram. So when there was a conflict in the way when they viewed a situation, Hashem said, you know, who wins? Sarah wins. She has a clearer understanding of what's going on, and Avraham, you have to listen to her. In the Hakdama to Gevuras Hashem, which is the Maharal Sefer on Maharal Miprag, the Maharal Sefer on the holiday of Pesach, he has a few Hakdamas, a few general introductions to the Sefer. And, I mean, it's a long sefer, but one of them is discussing why is Olam Haba, why is the world to come, or the eternal nature of a person's neshama, not mentioned in Chumash. It's mentioned in Nevi'im, it's mentioned a little bit in Nevi'im, but for the most part, in Chumash for sure, it never talks about what happens after you die. It never says that anything happens after you die. It doesn't really make any explicit allusions to the fact that there's a world to come. It doesn't make any explicit allusions that your soul continues on even after you die. There comes, you know, there's a future for it as well. So one would think that that's fundamental, right? That the Chumash really should be talking about such an idea if it were true. Now, obviously, the Gemara, the Tosha Baal Peh, is replete with this, meaning pages and pages and pages, obviously. But in the Chumash itself, it's not mentioned. So why is that? Why is such a fundamental idea not given over in Torah's Moshe? So the Maharal says that this is a question that many Rishonim address. The answer the Maharal gives is, he says, Torah is a function of prophecy, meaning Moshe received prophecy of the Torah from Hashem, from Kadosh Baruch Hu, and then he relayed that prophecy to the Jewish people. That's what Torah Shebichsav in general is. The written Torah that we have, Tanakh, is all a form of prophecy, meaning Moshe or the lesser prophets, the Joshua, etc., they received prophecy from Kadosh Baruch Hu, and then they wrote it down. Now, prophecy, the Maharal explains, is not it's not a straight-up intellectual exercise. It's actually a physical experience, right? When I see something, I see the thing, meaning there's a physical interaction which allows me to see it. I can then think about it. I can think about the implications, and that becomes a mental exercise. But the comprehension itself is a physical exercise. I see something, I hear something, I taste something, I ingest that information. Prophecy, we call another word for a prophet in Tanakh is choza, which means a seer, or a roah, which also means a seer. Prophecy is literally the Navi having the capacity to see things beyond the ken of standard human ability, and then relaying the information that he saw to his fellow Jews. Olam Haba, and the Navi says at one point, is Ayin Lo Rasa, Yishai says, that no eye has seen it, meaning it's not something that could be conceived of in our present physical state. It's beyond, it's supernatural in a way that we can't comprehend it with the physical tools that we have right now. So because of that, the Maharal says, since Nevuah is, it's exalted and elevated, but in the end, it's a human activity where a human comprehends, they sense something, God shows them something which they see in their prophetic eye, and then they relay it to others. Things which are beyond human capacity cannot be seen in prophecy. So since the Torah itself is a function of prophecy, it can't mention Olam Haba, because Olam Haba is something that is beyond the ken of our capacity to see at the present moment. In the Torah Shebaal Peh, though, intellectually, we can extrapolate its existence, and once we know of it, we can define it and talk about it. There could be many, many pages about it, but the Torah itself not. In our context, Sarah Avram was told regarding Sarah, her ability to see is unencumbered, and especially in this case, where Avram's love for Yishmael might have clouded in some way his ability to understand, to see the truth of any given situation in regards to Yishmael. Sarah, who was unencumbered, had a much clearer vision of what God intended in that specific situation, and God said, indeed, she is correct in this sense. Avram, you have to be subservient to her, and whatever she says to do with the family, she is seeing it 100% correctly, and listen to her in everything that she tells you. Stop here.